I thought what I would do would be to begin my presentation this evening with my first demonstration. And to do that, I brought along some assistants, my little black and white juggling cows. Good evening, everyone. I want you to ask yourself the following question. Is what you're observing ordinary or extraordinary? I'm liking it. Well, let's see. It's ordinary. Any IBM scientist can do this in front of an audience at ITP after dinner. It's extraordinary in the sense that you probably were not expecting it. But what I want you to do is to think of me, come back here, little cow. Think of me as a bag of atoms, a whole bunch of atoms stuck together, and ask yourself, how is it that a whole bunch of atoms stuck together can stand in front of an audience and juggle? How is it that you and you, bags of atoms, all stuck together, can actually watch what I'm doing and somehow understand what I'm doing, somehow be the recipient of the communication and go about your lives just as a bag of atoms? It is an extraordinary thing that something as simple as an atom, and then the variation that we have as we go to atom in the periodic table, and then sticking them together in the kinds of configurations that we have names for, like human being, ends up with something that has such an incredible functionality. How can this be? Science has been asking that question for many, many years, probably since the Greeks, possibly even before the Greeks. And we have many answers to that question. We also have still many open issues. One of the things that we can say about a human system is that that functionality comes at all levels. There's a sort of hierarchy of structure, and at each level of structure there's functionality. There's functionality at the very macro structure. For instance, you can talk about the bones in my arm, and you can say how they were contributing to the ability of me to juggle. But there's also smaller and smaller and smaller hierarchies. And if we ask ourselves, what is the smallest hierarchy which enables me to stand in front of you, make such a fool of myself? It was probably at the atomic, or certainly at the molecular scale. And it is through these hierarchies of functionality, of assemblies of atoms, that we end up with something which is as unusual and extraordinary as a human being that can stand up in front of you and juggle. Not me in particular, but just the very idea that you could take these elements of the periodic table, stick them together, and end up with that kind of functionality. Now, there are other structures that we're well aware of, also made from atoms, that have much limited functionality compared to something as complex as a human being, and still yet extraordinary functionalities. Here's one of them, my computer right in front of me. This computer also has hierarchies of structures, but its level of functionality, most of us would agree, is nowhere near what the level of functionality or the complexity of functionality that we find in a human. Now, it happens that I work for this little blue company, perhaps you've heard of it, IBM. And the thing that fuels our industry, and the thing that I'm really concerned with in my research, is the ability to deliver year after year after year an increased level of functionality in the products that we call computers that we provide to our customers. How are we going to get more functionality? How have we got more functionality? The recipe for our industry has been to shrink the size of the structures that do computation so we can pack into something as small as this more and more computation, and we get more and more functionality out of our computers. We can ask ourselves, and we do ask ourselves, how far can we take this? We're certainly nowhere near the other example that I gave you, the example of a human being. If you look at this chip in here, which does most of the computation on my computer, you'll find that the size of the structure, the characteristic size of the structure, which really does the computation, is on the order of a tenth of a micron. That's 1,000 angstroms. That's about 500 atoms across. And on biological length scales, that's a gigantic object. So we might have the hope, anyway, that in the future, we could create smaller structures which can do the computation, which might provide whole new ways to do computation, and which could deliver a level of complexity and functionality to our customers, which is very, very much beyond what we have available to us today. That's my job. And what I'm going to talk to you about tonight is our search for the onset of functionality in extremely small structures. What happens when we take a couple of atoms and put them together and see if we can make it do something that is useful, right, and something that we can learn from and perhaps someday incorporate in our technologies? That's what my talk is all about. If we can get this guy doing something other than the color blue, although blue is very nice. Let me see if I have to press a button over here. That's one. There we go. Oh, that's my first correct button of the evening. If I can make it through the whole evening that way, I'll be doing great. I've chosen as the title of my presentation this evening, Building Things with Atoms, a report from the small frontier, where the small frontier is the frontier that many scientists around the world are working on nowadays. It's the frontier of being able to control things and to explore what happens on the scale of atoms. And what you see here is an image, and I'll be talking a lot about the kind of instrument which can give you images like this, where in this image you'll see this giant blue thing right here, that's an atom. That just happens to be an iron atom. We happen to put it there. I'm going to describe how we do that, why we're motivated to do that, and what are some of the consequences of doing that. And hopefully, I'll do it in a way which can bring you along and get you enthused about this kind of work. It's certainly something that keeps me enthused all the time. So let me begin by telling you a little bit about the instrument which gives us access to the world of atoms, to not only see where they are, but to be able to interact with them by moving them around. That instrument is called the scanning tunneling microscope, and it's an extraordinary instrument. It was created by these two characters here, my colleagues Gerd Binnig and Heini Rohrer. They were at IBM's Zurich Research Laboratory. And in the early 1980s, they invented this thing called the scanning tunneling microscope. For this invention, they won the 1986 Nobel Prize in Physics. And I often think that Gerd certainly deserved two Nobel Prizes in Physics, one not only for the scanning tunneling microscope, but for the tunneling microscope's younger brother, the atomic force microscope. That's something that I won't mention anymore this evening. I'll concentrate on the scanning tunneling microscope. So let me tell you a little bit about how this microscope works. It is an absolutely amazing tool. When you think of conventional microscopes, what is the first thing that comes into your mind? You might remember some microscope you maybe had as a child. I remember the microscope that was in the chemistry set my mother got me when I was a kid, and had a single eyepiece, and you look through it and you see something small. And you might be familiar with electron microscopes of various kinds. How do those microscopes work? They work by being able to bend waves. They take either light waves or electron waves and bend them in a way so that the wave fronts expand, like the way my fingers are expanding as a wave expands. And that takes something which is small, for instance, the spacing between my fingers, and makes it large. It allows us to, as a result, see something small because we can control those waves and do optics with those waves and expand those waves. The tunneling microscope is much more like another microscope that at least 90% of this audience knows about, but doesn't normally think of it as a microscope. Perhaps you've heard of something called a phonograph. Many of you look old enough to know what a phonograph is. There's at least one person back there who looks young enough to not know what a phonograph is. No, it's you. Don't look behind you. Come on. Have you ever thought of a phonograph as a kind of microscope? Okay, let's remember what a phonograph is. There's this turntable, and you take a record and you stick it on it. That record has grooves in it. Then the arm is lowered, and the needle at the end of the arm goes down into the groove, and the groove gets dragged past the needle. If you look carefully at that groove in the record, you'll find that there are tiny bumps that line the two surfaces of the groove. As the groove with its bumps gets dragged past the needle, those bumps cause the needle to wiggle back and forth. That wiggling of the needle is transduced by the cartridge into a small electrical signal. That signal is made large by your stereo system's amplifier, and it is presented to your brain as an audible image through your ears. But if you gave me the opportunity, instead of taking the signal that goes to the speakers and sending it to the speakers, I could reroute that same signal to a computer. In my case, it would be an IBM computer. Perhaps you'd choose an IBM also. And please, I'm a salesman and a lunatic. You have to put up with me for the next hour. You could have the computer record the variation in that electrical signal and draw for you a picture of what those tiny bumps look like. And guess what? You would have then an image to look at with your eyes of something that's actually quite small. Those bumps in the groove are small. You can't see them with your unaided eye. And so you could call it a microscope. That's very similar to the way the scanning tunneling microscope works. Let me describe it to you. It's deceptively and beautifully simple. This is it. It's a metal needle, and we bring it close to the surface that we want to image. Everything else is just in the details. But this is going to, I love it when people laugh at me, right? It's laugh as much as you need. And importantly so, this should be enjoyable. It really should be enjoyable. That's why I do it. It's that simple, but let's see where the devil is and how it works. Imagine that we're looking at the surface from the side, and so the material comes up like this, and it's terminated right here. These are the outermost atoms of the material that we want to image, and out here there's nothing. For the sake of argument, let it just be vacuum. We bring this metal needle nearby to the surface, where this represents I can use this pointer here. This is to represent the last few atoms at the end of the metal needle. The needle has to end somewhere. These are the last few atoms. And we have a mechanism for bringing this needle up very carefully to the surface that we want to image. And that mechanism I label over here as a Z servo. Z stands for the axis perpendicular to the surface. We'll call it the Z direction. And servo means something that can elongate or contract in order to mechanically move this tip further away or closer to the surface. Now, at the same time, we apply a small voltage difference between the tip and the underlying surface, and that's schematically represented by this electronic schematic representation of a battery or a voltage source. And the consequence of having a voltage difference between the tip and the underlying surface is that will cause an electric current to flow right around this loop, and that's indicated here. We have electrons that flow all the way around this loop. And most importantly, in order to get across this gap here, they have to tunnel. They would not classically be allowed to go across that gap. And it's not important for you to understand the details of the tunneling mechanism. The only thing that's important for you to keep in mind is that the amount of electric current that flows across here is extraordinarily sensitive to how wide this gap is. That gap we usually keep to about 2 or 3 atomic diameters, and if it's much more than that, that current becomes really too small for us to conveniently measure. And more importantly, if you were to take the tip of the microscope and move it back, let's say half an atomic diameter, by using this thing I call the Z servo, we would find that the electric current that flows would be decreased by an order of magnitude, by a factor of 10. It's very, very sensitive to how wide this gap is over here. And that's the genius of the tunneling microscope. That's what's going to make the tunneling microscope work. So what we do is, in the circuit, we insert a device which can measure how much electric current flows, and then send a signal back, indicated over here in yellow, back to the Z servo to move the tip up or down to achieve some desired amount of electric current. And that will stabilize the electric current by adjusting the height of the tip to keep the current at some predefined value. We can then add another servo into the mechanism. I'll call it the X servo, and its purpose is going to be to move the tip in this diagram, let's say, from left to right. So when it gets some signal from, in our case, a computer, it can move the tip from left to right. And the consequence is that if this mechanism keeps electric current constant, the tip will execute whatever trajectory is necessary to keep the electric current constant as the tip is being scanned along the surface. And that means it's going to first approximation, follow the contours of the surface. And because the amount of current that flows across that gap is so sensitive to how wide that gap is, we find that these tip trajectories often have corrugations which we can readily measure, which show us the corrugation of the surface with atomic resolution. It is an extraordinary instrument. There is no doubt about it. How do we get the information back to ourselves? What we do is we have a computer. I think right up there is the little IBM logo on it. It receives a signal from this current controller, which tells us what the tip trajectory is, and the computer plots the tip trajectory, just as in the example of the phonograph, I had the computer plot for you what the shape of the bumps were. So I can see the shapes of the atoms, or if you like, what I really see is the shape of the trajectory here. And then by raster scanning the tip in the way that a TV raster scans a spot across the TV, we can build up a three-dimensional image of the surface. And I just pulled an image out of my files here to show you the way a three-dimensional image might look. And that's how the tunneling microscope works. And for those of us who have used the machine for 15, 17 years now, the wonder of this machine is in no way diminished. It is still an absolutely extraordinary instrument. And with any luck later on, I'll get you to actually see what it's like to run one of these machines. We'll be running the machine in my laboratory up in San Jose. Here's what it looks like. The one in my laboratory is a tunneling microscope, which is shown here. This is the business end of the microscope. This is shiny surface here is a sample that we would be looking at. And right over here is a metal tip. And here we have some piezoceramic crystals. Here's one here, another one back behind it, and a circular one, which is right about there. Those piezoceramic crystals are the X, the Y, and the Z servo mechanisms. Piezoceramics are materials which change their length a little bit when you apply an electric voltage to them. And when we apply the electric signals to these piezos, we cause them to change their length a little bit. That ends up moving the tip around a little bit. And you can think of this as a little robot, which can then take the tip and position it where you want it to go in a very small range. But that's okay. Atoms are very small things. How small are they? You take a typical atom, line up 100 million of them in a row. That would span the length from one side of my finger to another. And then in the end of my finger, there are 100 million, 100 million, 100 million atoms, which is a lot. About 10 to the 23rd for those of you who are comfortable with scientific notation. But one of the things I want you to appreciate, and I hope you'll get a feel for by the end of the talk, is atoms ain't as small as they used to be. All you need is to spend a whole morning tugging and pushing and cajoling and swearing at an atom that won't move when you want it to move, to realize just how big they are and how puny you are. It happens. The microscope that we'll be using and is the one that I built when I joined IBM. You see it here. It operates at 4 degrees Kelvin. That's 4 degrees above absolute zero. There are many motivations for having a low temperature microscope, but the primary one for what I'll be talking about tonight is just to hold the atom still. At higher temperatures, atoms start shaking, and then they start hopping around all over the place, and sometimes even evaporating from the surface. Have you ever tried to put clothes on a four-year-old who's had too much sugar pumped into their body? It's really good when the things that you want to work with hold still for you. Low temperature holds the atoms still for us. In addition, this microscope is an ultra-high vacuum. This is just some buzzwords to describe a level of vacuum which we can achieve in our laboratory, which is appropriate for preparing and maintaining atomically clean, well-characterized surfaces. If I were to take a real-world surface, like the surface of this laser pointer here, and just put it in my microscope and take a look at it, even if I could look at it with my microscope, it would be entirely too confusing for us to work with. There's layers and layers of garbage on top of this. There's elastomers and fingerprints and molecules from the air and everything else. We like to start off with as pristine a system as we can possibly get, and then to make it interesting in a controlled way. And you'll see examples of that shortly. To give you an idea about the overall scale of this, you can see down here, this is about 1 centimeter across, so that everything that you see in this picture could very easily fit in the palm of your hand. And this is really the business end of the business end of the microscope is just this. This is about 1 centimeter across or so. They are not big instruments. In fact, once you know how to build them, they're quite easy to build. I understand high school students have built tunneling microscopes for their high school science projects. They may not work at low temperature and an ultra-high vacuum, but they can, under limited circumstances, still show you the atomic structure of certain surfaces. As I mentioned, the microscope is at low temperature and in vacuum. This is the backside of the microscope that you see here. There's a glass vacuum jar around it. So inside this jar, there's vacuum. And then everything that you see in this image is cooled to the temperature of liquid helium, to 4 degrees Kelvin. That vacuum chamber is located down here inside of our liquid helium doer, which is suspended from a vibration isolation table. And up on top here are the vacuum chambers that where we do the initial sample preparation, where we get clean surfaces to work with, and we take our samples after we've cleaned them and put them down onto the microscope. And then it's really the PC which ends up controlling everything. The PC creates the control signals which move the tip in the raster pattern. It records what the trajectory of the tip was as a function of where the tip was in the raster pattern, and then renders for us a variety of different images which allow us to readily interpret what we're looking at with the microscope. My favorite atom, xenon. I like to use this image to re-emphasize a point that I tried to bring up before about how big the atomic world has become for us, and also what an extraordinary instrument the tunneling microscope is in its imaging capabilities. In this image, the vertical scale has been greatly exaggerated in order to convey the content of the information. If I had not done that, you would not be able to see the corrugation of the surrounding metal surface. This is an individual xenon atom sitting on top of a surface which happens to be nickel in this particular case. And as you can see, the vertical size of the atom is now very high compared to the corrugation that we see out here in the plane. And indeed, the tunneling microscope can see down to dimensions much smaller than an atomic size. The one that we'll be using later on tonight can see down to about 1/10,000th of an atomic diameter. An atom is a large thing. What I'd like to do now is to switch over to using the video recorder, and I want to take you on a little tour of a surface to give you an idea about what one of these scanning tunneling microscope images looks like. No signal. Let's see if that works. And I'll give you a little tour of the surface here. No signal is like the kiss of death. Let's just see why when I press video. Hey, there we go. We have a long ways to go with respect to technology. Welcome to the world of atoms and to a surface. This happens to be a sample, which is made from the metal nickel, and on top of it we sprayed some xenon atoms. What you're seeing here is a surface, well, this is a xenon atom right here. It's this big bump that is standing out over here. We see a couple interesting other features on the surface. These are two smaller bumps. They don't fit in the sense that they're not like the other xenon atoms. What are they? We call those things dirt. Dirt is anything which we don't understand, which we didn't intentionally put on the surface, and is a result of less than perfect sample preparation. There's all kinds of scientific questions that you can ask. For instance, here's a cluster of xenon atoms. Why does this cluster have this shape? How did that cluster form? The xenon atoms arrived on the surface as individual atoms, and yet we find them sometimes as clusters. How did that happen? By working our way through that process, we learn about how an atom comes in and scatters and moves along the surface and comes to rest. There's a whole bunch of other questions that data like this suggests. This is actually just one STM image, but we're looking at it with the computer afterwards and in 3D. For instance, here's a cluster of three xenon atoms at a step edge. And why does the center one appear to be taller than the two outer ones? That teaches us about how the electrons around the xenon atoms are arranging themselves. These step edges, some of them are triple height step edges with an interesting pattern along the step edge itself. How did that happen? Can we understand that? Those are the kinds of scientific questions that keep surface scientists busy, and which the scanning tunneling microscope plays a very important role in terms of giving us a direct view of what's going on the surface. So now let me tell you a little bit about how we learned to use this instrument, which was invented as a set of eyes, as a set of hands for manipulating atoms on a surface. What we do is we take advantage of a very wonderful fact, something that I rejoice in every morning when I wake up and I find myself to be intact. And that is that atoms are sticky. They really enjoy sticking to one another. They form chemical bonds and they like to stick to one another. In fact, I think all neutral atoms, electrically neutral atoms, given the choice, would like to come and stick to one another with various degrees of stickiness, if you like. If we have an atom on top of a surface, we have a jargon name for that. We call that an ad atom. Let's just call it an atom on top of a surface, shown here in blue. If we like, we can bring the outermost atom of the tip close to this atom. Remember, we have the ability to move this tip around with extraordinary precision. We can control the position of this outermost atom with, if we want to move it a hundredth of an atomic diameter to the left, well, we do it. We just go ahead and do it. And this atom here would like to stick to one another. And what we can do is control how hard they pull on one another by controlling how close they are. Atoms are kind of like little bar magnets that you can play with. You know how if you have bar magnets far apart from one another, they don't seem to pull on one another very hard? As you bring them closer and closer together, they start to really suck hard to one another. Atoms are very much the same way. So what we can do is we can control how hard we pull on this atom by bringing this atom either further or closer to the atom nearby. And it turns out that there's a set of conditions, which we can often achieve in our laboratory, where the amount of tug that this atom exerts on this atom is sufficient so that when we take the whole tip and move the tip sideways, it will drag this ad atom along the surface. That atom stays bound to the surface. It doesn't leave the surface and jump up onto the tip. It just gets dragged along by the tip to some new location. We then just drag the atom along to where we want it to go, and then we just pull the tip back to make it so that the outermost atom on the tip doesn't pull so hard on the atom that's on the surface. And then we've done it. That's all there is to atom manipulation. So we have these two modes of using the microscope. One is the imaging mode shown here. In the imaging mode, the tip is kept far enough away from the atom on the surface so that the atom stays fixed. And then as we scan the tip over the atom, the tip would typically move up and over the atom in order to keep the electrical current constant. We record this trajectory. we see it on the computer and say something profound like, oh, there's a bump. And that's something we do in IBM, is create profound sayings. Other companies are just as guilty. And then to manipulate the atom, all we do is we bring the tip sufficiently close so that this stickiness, this chemical bond that forms between the atom on the tip and the atom on the surface, is sufficient to drag the atom along the surface. And here's the first atom. This was September 28th, 1989. It was a xenon atom on top of a platinum surface. And because the platinum surface was so slippery to the xenon atom, I couldn't just put the xenon atom anywhere. I could leave it anywhere I wanted to, but then when I went to image it, it would inadvertently be moved during the imaging process. So what I had to do was to move the atom back and forth between defects, that is dirt, on this platinum surface. It turns out that there was a defect right here. You can see it in this image, the before image, and there's a defect here where the atom was stuck here. So what happened was the atom was here. I programmed the computer to move the tip over the atom, lower the tip towards the atom to make the chemical bond between the atom and the tip strong enough. And then the tip was instructed by the computer to move along the trajectory that you see here in red. And then once the tip got to this position here, the computer pulled the tip back, severing that chemical bond and leaving the xenon atom bound to the surface. And now you see the xenon atom at its new location over here, atom number one. That was very quickly followed by the corporate graffiti that David showed you earlier this evening, which was to take individual xenon atoms and spell out IBM. The purpose of doing this was really twofold. One is it demonstrated one of the hallmarks of science, and that is reproducibility. A scientist needs to be able to reproduce their own experiments, and that's an absolutely critical and essential part of science. It cannot be emphasized enough. It is what distinguishes science from pseudoscience. This demonstrated that we could take xenon atoms and put them where we wanted to go over and over again. There was another very strong motivation for doing this, and that is that if I were to take off my shirt right now, and I'm not about to, but if I were, you would see a big blue stripe running up and down my spine. I was, if you hadn't noticed, I was incredibly beholden, as I am today, to a company which gave me the opportunity to be successful. It's a wonderful place to work, and this was payback time. I really felt like this was a joy for me to be able to do it, as it is to talk about it 11 years later, 12 years later. Okay, beyond graffiti, what can you do if you can move atoms around? You can go to town, scientifically and perhaps even technologically. Let me give you an example of how we use atom manipulation as a scientific tool, which is what I really believe is its greatest strength. If you can move atoms around, you can bring them close to one another and stick them together. You can build molecules. You can build molecules that never existed before. And you might be able to learn about how chemical reactions happen on surfaces in ways that might not be readily accessible through other experimental techniques. Here's some examples. We started off with a copper surface. You're going to see copper surfaces over and over tonight. As a matter of fact, you're only going to see copper surfaces from here on out. This is a copper surface. On top of this copper surface, we sprayed some iodine molecules. Iodine is a diatomic molecule, two iodine atoms stuck together. They come down, they hit the copper surface, and they spontaneously break apart into individual iodine atoms, which are nearby to one another. So that when we image them, we see them as that they come in pairs. To this surface, we added cesium atoms. Cesium is all the way over on the left-hand side of the periodic table. Iodine is next to the right-hand side. This is very similar to plain old table salt, which is sodium chloride. Cesium is an analog to sodium, and iodine is an analog to chlorine. And so we tried to build some simple structures from cesium and iodine. Here's what happens when we stick one cesium to one iodine atom. Notice, by the way, that I don't have a picture of an isolated cesium atom. And the reason I don't is because this copper surface presents almost no barrier for the cesium to move sideways. And the consequence of that is that when we try to image the cesium with the tip of the microscope, as the tip of the microscope goes over an isolated cesium atom, it is already exerting enough force on the cesium atom to drag it along. On this particular surface, cesium will not hold still to have its picture taken. It would if we could move the tip much farther away, but by then the tip is too far away, we can't get enough electric current. Too bad. Here's what happens when you have a cesium and a single iodine atom both stuck together to form a cesium iodide. The reason it looks this way is the apparent height of cesium is much greater than the iodine. And because the copper surface is so slippery to the cesium atom, during the imaging process, the cesium atom is moved all around the iodine atom, which stays fixed on the surface. So it ends up giving us this structure, which if you didn't know it was cesium iodide and you didn't suspect that it was very slippery, you'd look at that and say, what kind of ring-shaped molecule is this? Right. I want to emphasize that there are many pitfalls to just looking at scanning tunneling microscope images and trying to make ready interpretations of it in terms of the positions of the atoms. Hopefully we won't fall into any this evening, but more than one or two scientists have done so. Here's a variety of other structures which we built just by snapping together the individual units. And then this is an interesting structure, cesium-2, iodine-2. What is interesting about that is we found that once we had assembled this, we could take that structure and as a unit move it around. And it became our Lego block for building larger structures. So we built a mess of these structures and then started snapping them together. And that's what you see here. These are four cesium-2, iodine-2 units that are snapped together to form a cesium-8, iodine-8 unit, which itself could then just be manipulated as a unit on top of the surface. Why were we interested in doing that? We could learn a little bit about chemical reactions on surfaces. For instance, the way these units snap together, they snap together in an orientation similar to the way I'm holding my hands with respect to one another. We were curious, if you brought one of the units in like this, would it snap together or not? Can we learn about the barriers that have to be overcome in order for them to snap together into an assembled unit? That's the beginning of science, and we can begin to learn a little bit about that by doing this kind of experimentation. Indeed, we built larger structures. This is a cesium-18, iodine-18 unit here, where we've used our imaging capabilities to just begin to image the iodine, or where the iodine atoms might be in the center of this backbone. And it turns out that with a few approximations, by doing this kind of experiment, we can actually work our way backwards to bond distances and bond angles for as complex a structure as this cesium-18, iodine-18 unit. It's the beginning of doing science with molecules, which comes about from your ability to assemble very unique structures and from the assembly process itself. Now, I would point out that, well, I can't say for sure, I would say it's highly doubtful that molecules like this on the surface have ever existed before. They would not normally assemble thermodynamically. What I mean by that is that if you put the stuff on the surface and then just heated the surface up, it's very unlikely that structures like this would naturally occur. Here's the copper 111 surface. 111 is just a reference to how we cut our way through the copper crystal. You're going to see a lot of this surface tonight. Let me give you a little tour of it because I want you to understand some of the really wonderful things about the surface. Now, these structures here are step edges. This is where the crystal of atoms goes up just one layer. So that's what you see here. This is where you go up just one more layer of atoms. In this image, as in all these STM images I'm showing you, the vertical scale has been greatly exaggerated. This is just about two-thirds of an atomic diameter, but if you were to count how many of the copper atoms there would be from left to right across the back of this image, there would be about 300 or so, about 200 or so across the back of the image. So this has been greatly exaggerated in the direction perpendicular to the surface. And I needed to do that because had I not exaggerated the data, this exaggeration is done on the computer afterwards, you wouldn't see all these ripples in the surface. That the surface, this plane here would appear to be completely flat. What are these ripples? those ripples are a godsend to a scientist. What it is, and we've known this for years and long before the tunneling microscope, is that on the copper 111 surface, there is a group of electrons, a class of electrons, which are different from the electrons which move freely throughout the bulk of the copper. Copper is a metal, and what makes a metal is the ability of electrons to move freely through the interior. That's what makes a metal a good electrical conductor, a good thermal conductor, a good reflector of light. On this surface, there are electrons which are trapped in the surface. They can't go down into the interior. But on the surface itself, the electrons are free to move about in a way very similar to the way they're free to move about in the interior of the solid. Now, electrons are fundamentally waves. That's what quantum theory has taught us. And here's the data right here. When a wave comes along and it bounces into something, it typically results in a backscattered wave. Go into your bathtub and experiment sometime, or just tap a cup of coffee. We've all seen this. You create a wave, it comes along, it hits something, it bounces back. But a wave isn't just a single disturbance, it's a whole wave train of crests and valleys. So pretend my fingers are all the crests. And a wave comes along and it hits something, and you end up with a wave train moving backwards at the same time that you have a wave train moving forward. And when you add the two together, you get what we call standing waves. Standing waves are regions where you have a lot of oscillation, and next to it, a place where you have no oscillation, another region where you have a lot of oscillation and no oscillation. That's just what we're seeing here. These ripples are due to the electrons that move freely in the plane. They come along, they hit a step edge like this. They are reflected, and the reflected part of the wave adds to the incoming part of the electron's wave, creating standing waves. And that's what we get to directly image with the tunneling microscope. Now, what's wonderful about this is here we get to see what the wave nature of the electron is doing at the level where we can see the consequence of the waviness itself. These are not the waves per se, they are the consequence of the waves. They are density waves. But it tells us everything that we would love to know about this. We can learn about the wavelength. We can ask ourselves questions like, how is it that some of the dirt out here on the surface, for instance, here's a chunk of dirt, probably a sulfur atom, but you knew that. And it's kicking up some waves. We see the rings around it. But look, here's another piece of dirt. What's different about that? That's not kicking up the waves. Well, answering questions like that is the stuff of science. It keeps us busy. What we wanted to do was to test whether we could trap electrons inside of very small structures and study the properties of electrons inside of very small structures. And here we have the opportunity to study what they're doing because we can see the consequence of their waving. We can see these, technically, they're density waves. And so what we did was we sprayed a bunch of iron atoms on top of the copper surface. So we had individual iron atoms, all initially at random locations. Then we used atom manipulation abilities I described before to assemble something that we call the quantum corral, which is what you see here. This is a ring of 48 iron atoms. The iron atoms were originally in random positions. We just moved them into this ring-shaped structure. To give you an idea about the scale of this ring, it's about 71 angstroms in radius. So if you could see the individual copper atoms, that would be about 28 or so copper atoms from the center out to the edge here. And we did this with the purpose of trying to trap electrons in the interior and see that we were trapping them and learn about their properties. What you see in here is the wave pattern, more properly the density distribution, of the electrons at a particular energy level which are trapped inside of the structure. So what I want you to get a feel for is we have now gone from just this curiosity of being able to see the electron waves on the surface and this curiosity of being able to move atoms around to be able to actively construct structures, to control what the electrons are doing, and to understand what the electrons are doing. We have a very good understanding of what the electrons are doing inside this structure. Right? And they're doing some very interesting things. And I'm going to give an example of how interesting that can be. Here's something that we created a couple years ago. And it's an effect which we were not exactly looking for, but we found and we got very fascinated with. In this corral, the atoms are not in a circle, they're in an ellipse. Now perhaps many of you can remember from your geometry class that an ellipse has a special property. It has two positions in the ellipse which are called the foci, and the distance from one focus to any place on the ellipse, which I'll call the wall, as I would in this corral, and then from that position on the wall over to the other focus is independent of where on the wall you choose to make that measurement. And that means an ellipse has a very special property. If you were a wave, let me draw an ellipse here. And here's one focus here, and here's another focus here. If you were to drop a pebble into an elliptical pond at one focus, what would you see? At first you would see an outgoing circular shaped wave emanating from the focus where you dropped the pebble. That wave would move out, it would hit the boundaries of the pond, but then that wave would coalesce in phase over here, and after a while you would have a huge oscillation at that point, because the path length from focus to wall to focus is the same regardless of where on the wall you go. And we wanted to exploit that to try to create an electronic connection between this focus over here and that focus over there. So what we did was to create an elliptical shaped corral to measure what the electrons were doing in the interior of that corral, and then to perturb what the electrons were doing by putting one additional atom in the interior of the corral at one of the foci. And then what you see up here in this green map is, roughly speaking, a map of how the electrons have changed what they're doing as a result of that one additional atom at the focus. Well, we see that the electrons have changed a lot what they're doing right at the side of this atom, and that was to be expected. An atom is a big perturbation for an electron. But what came as a surprise was that there was another place where there was a large change in what the electrons were doing, and that was right over at the other focus where that atom was not. We call this place where there was large change or mirage. And the term mirage we use, it came to mind because we thought of a mirage as being due to the fact that when light starts from one source, it gets bent. And so when you look at it after it's been bent, you see it coming from an apparent position, which is not the real source. In a similar way, here the electrons, as waves get reflected or bent by the walls, create a large effect where the original source was not. We call that a quantum mirage. Now, one of the things I tried to stress when I introduced this talk was the search for functionality in extremely small structures. This structure is extremely small compared to the size of the structures which do the computation in my computer. But guess what? Here's functionality. It's right here, it's right in front of us. What am I showing you? What I'm showing you is the ability to transport information from one place to another, which, by the way, is hugely important, not just in telecommunications, but inside of any computer chip that you go to. An awful lot that goes on inside of a computer chip is just moving information from one place to another. And I try to emphasize that in this view graph. Here we have a top-down view of an elliptical corral, which is empty, and so there is no mirage. This is the mirage image over here, and it's just black. We add a single atom to the position of the focus of this ellipse, which is over here, and we now have a mirage over on the other side. So what that means is that the presence of this atom over here is creating a measurable signal at a distance away. That's called information transport. That's something that we're very interested in. This is a very interesting kind of information transport. It's very different than what we conventionally use in our modern chip technology. The way we conventionally send information around inside of a chip is to run a wire from place to place, and we send an electric current down the wire. If there's electric current flowing, we say, for instance, that is a 1. If there's no electric current flowing, we call it a 0. Here we could call the presence of the mirage a 1, or the absence of the mirage a 0. And by, for instance, just moving this atom around or putting it in and out of the corral, or by doing something perhaps a little bit faster, we can send information to the other side. But the way in which that information gets there and the power dissipation involved with it is very different from a wire. And now I'm going to show you something that you can do with the mirages that you can never do with wires. The reason is that the mirage really takes advantage of the wave nature of electrons. With wires, it's just like having a hose, and you either flow water through it or you don't. But you don't really take advantage of the fact that electrons are waves. When we build very small structures, the quantum nature of electrons, in fact, the fundamental nature of electrons, the fact that they are waves, from the minute that they wake up in the morning till they go to sleep at night, is something that is unavoidable and perhaps exploitable and perhaps useful. Here's an example. We carefully quantum engineered a set of crossed ellipses shown here with the purpose of being able to control the mirages in a way that might be useful. Here, the set of crossed ellipses are empty in the interior, and so there are no mirages. Over here, we've placed a single atom in what we'll call the left-right channel, and there's a mirage over here, over on the right side. So we're sending information from here to here, but notice that nothing is really happening between here and here. That is, there's no mirage in the up-down channel. Here we have an atom in the up-down channel. Here's the mirage in the up-down channel over here, but notice nothing is happening in the left-right channel. And here we have two atoms and two mirages. What this demonstrates is something which we take for granted every day when we use waves, and that is waves readily pass through one another. Right now, I can look at you, you can look at me, and the people on the left side of the room, the right side of the room can look at one another, and our photons go right through one another, no problem. We do it with light, we do it with sound, we can do it with water waves out here on the ocean. Here we're doing something entirely analogous, we're just doing it with electron waves. But because we exploit the wave nature, we do real wave engineering to get to this, it allows us to send two channels of information, in fact we could in principle send as many as we like, through the same volume of space. That is something that we cannot do when we send electrons down a wire in a conventional way. Now, is that important? First thing, we don't know how to put this into our technologies. We have many challenges to get this into our technologies. We don't know whether we can make it work fast enough. We don't know how it would be manufactured. Believe me, the list of problems is Promethean. But we can look to it and identify potential advantages even now. For instance, if you were to take apart the chip that's in my computer, the CPU, and look at it, what you'd find is there was this wafer of silicon, and the active devices, the transistors, were built right into that layer of silicon. And then there would be some insulators, and then on top of that, you would find, I think, about 8 layers of wiring. Why do we need 8 layers of wiring? It's because we have so much information to move from place to place inside that chip, and the wires can't touch one another. Well, if they can't touch, we've got to send some over, and then another one's got to go over, and then they got to go under, and it gets incredibly complex. Here is a pathway, at least in principle, for simplifying the wiring inside of chips by being able to exploit the wave nature of electrons. And so we begin to see or to imagine how we can get new kinds of functionality by exploiting the properties of really small structures. For me, that's called job security. And it's a lot of fun. Okay, what I'd like to do now is to show you another video. Let me press all the buttons over here. I had many videotaping done in my laboratory, but this one is extraordinary. I want you to just watch it. And let's see if it just turns on and starts on its own. Oh, we saw that blue screen. Hang on. I haven't quite figured out, other than some buttons just need to be pressed twice. No signal. Okay, I don't know what that means. Let's try doing that. We have audio.
Okay, I'll click this.
Click on that button. No, let me back it up. Can we get that thing doing the VCR? Let's try that.
I'll click this.
Click on that button. Right. I have to back it up here just a little bit. Okay. What you're going to see is a segment that they shot for a program called The New Edge. This is Richard Clark.
Okay, I'll click this.
Click on that button, right. Don't worry, everybody's a little nervous the first time. So why don't you go get an atom. Now click on the lower one. Excellent. Okay, you've got the atom. Now try dragging it out to the center of the image.
It's a miracle! Yes!
See that? We still experience. That to me was an extraordinary moment. For years I'd had people come into my laboratory, and it's always fun to have visitors. They get to move atoms around, and they almost always walk away with an extraordinary smile on their face. There's something which is somehow more than just a surface layer experience, no pun intended. But when I saw that video, it really struck me that the experience of moving around an atom is something which is really powerful. I needed to share in a way which I couldn't do by just having visitors come to my laboratory. I had to bring my laboratory to visitors. And so we got together a bunch of people and said, well, how can we bring this to a much broader base of people, and in particular school children? They're really my target audience. And we decided, let's use that web. That web should be able to do it. The technology is there. We should be able to bring our laboratory to children all around the world by exploiting the web to be able to control the microscope from any remote position on the earth where you had a connection to the web. So what I'd like to do is to utilize that technology tonight and take you to my laboratory as best I can. Rather than put you all on an airplane or a bus, I'll bring the laboratory to you through the computer. So let's give that a try. First, let me tell you how we're going to do it. Let's go back. There we go. Here's the lab. It's up in San Jose, California, about 250 miles north of here. The scanning tunneling microscope is in that wing of the building there. And I love to show this because, for those of you who've never been there, by the way, great place to work, wonderful site, especially if you like wildlife. The atomoscope is what we'll be using tonight. That's our web-based control of the scanning tunneling microscope. It starts with the STM itself, which I've already described to you. The STM is being controlled by our computer, which does the everyday control of the microscope with the raster scanning and all the rest. That computer is itself connected to what we call a proxy server. This is another computer which will take care of getting signals from the STM controller, giving signals to the STM controller, and then connecting that out onto the World Wide Web. And then that connects to the web client, which could be anywhere out in the world. And in this evening, it will be this computer right here. At the same time, we plan on being able to have a bazillion observers, so that when we do this with school children around the world, there will be one lucky controller, and at that point in time, everybody else gets to be an observer, and then we'll be able to pass off who gets to be the controller from client to client under our own control. They'll also be able to interact with us in the laboratory as best we can using the facilities of the web. Okay, let's try to connect to the lab. Let's Let's quit the screen show. And I need to tell this guy to connect back to the laboratory at Almaden. And it's going through the motions. I think we're connected. I'll run Internet Explorer. And I'll tell it to go to here we go. And we'll run the new prototype client. You guys are seeing all this, right? Good. I would be fine with me. Whatever you guys can do to accommodate this. Lower the lights a little bit, right? Yeah. That'll be good. This is the applet that was just served up over the web to my... Oh, that's great. Thank you very much. That was served up over the web to my computer here. This would be the same thing that you would get if you were at home or a school child somewhere. I need to log on. And there we go. Notice there's a little box right here. That's the area that we're going to scan in. And I'm going to ask software to zoom into that area. And I want to look at the derivative mode. And I'll tell it to scan. And I'll tell it that I want to see 3D at the same time. Welcome to my world. In real time, up in San Jose, there's the tip of the microscope scanning over the surface. The area that we're scanning over is not readily observable here. I happen to know that it's about 100 angstroms from left to right across this image. That is, it's about 100 angstroms from left here to right here. So if you could see the individual copper atoms, again, we're in that copper rut, there would be maybe 30 copper atoms from left to right there. On top of the surface, we place carbon monoxide molecules. Carbon monoxide is a diatomic molecule which is formed from one carbon atom and one oxygen atom. And we know from other experiments, not STM experiments, that when this molecule sticks to the copper surface, it doesn't lie flat on the surface. It lies with the carbon down and the oxygen directly on top of it, protruding out from the surface. So that when we image over it with the tunneling microscope, we don't get to directly observe any of the diatomicity of that molecule, not directly. We don't see two lumps. We just get to see a single lump. And that's what you're seeing here. Let me tell you about how this image is rendered. We assign grayscale in this image as if there was a light source, I'm not supposed to walk over here, shining from left to right, so that things that protrude from the surface will appear to be bright on their left side and dim or dark on their right side. But look, these are dark on their left side and bright on their right side. And in fact, if you look at the 3D image over here, you get maybe a better idea that these are dips. They're carbon monoxide molecule, even though it's sticking up from the surface, images as a dip. We can understand that in a variety of levels. For this evening's lecture, probably the simplest way to think about it is that carbon monoxide is itself an electrical insulator. It's difficult for the electrons to move through it. And so when the tip scans over the molecule, in order to keep the electric current constant, it has to move in closer to the molecule. There are much more precise ways to begin to describe that, but I think they're inappropriate for this evening's lecture. And besides, this is more of a fun evening. Up here we have it imaging in 3D. This tells us the line number. And here you get to see the individual line scans. You can get to see the little dips as the tip goes right across. So those are the individual trajectories of the tip as it scans across the surface. Okay, now I think we should move an atom. So I'll tell the computer to stop after this image, and then we'll go over here and say that we want to move an atom. This is a little bit difficult with this trackball and this handpiece here, but I'll try to do my best. Let's come up here, and then let's pick this molecule here. And then with one more click, let me put it right over the molecule. Oh, very good. And then I'll try moving the molecule to the left here. Oh, very nice. Yeah, this is really difficult with this handpiece. We'll move it down here. Are you hearing the computer making funny sounds?
Yeah.
That's really cool. I'm going to tell you what that is in just a second. Let's finish this off. Right. Okay, we'll get it down to there. One more click, and it should go back into the imaging mode. And guess what? This was a molecule that I tried to move. It ain't there no more. Yeah. Thank you. It's fun, huh? Yeah. What you're seeing now is an IBM scientist on a power trip, right? Let me tell you a little bit about the sound. The sound is extraordinarily useful for us. Remember, the tunneling microscope is both a set of eyes, as we're using it right now, and it was a set of hands when we were moving the molecule. But it's not a set of eyes and hands simultaneously. We can't actually see or know. We can't directly see whether the molecule is moving with the tip, but that's extraordinarily valuable to know that that's actually happening. Right? But this molecule is moving across a copper surface, and the copper surface is made out of individual copper atoms, which form a lattice of places for the carbon monoxide molecule to bind to. So the carbon monoxide likes to stick to one position in each one of the cells of that lattice. As we pull on it to move it, it likes to stick there, so it sort of lags behind until we pull hard enough, and then it snaps into the next cell of the surface. When it snaps, the electric current that flows between the tip and the sample momentarily goes out of regulation until our feedback mechanism and that Z servo can adjust the height of the tip to achieve the correct amount of electric current. When the current goes out of regulation, that is detected by circuitry in my laboratory. That tells the computer, aha, the molecule has moved. That information is sent over the web, and then this guy synthesizes a sound to let me know that the molecule has moved. So that I wasn't sweating it when it went back to doing the re-imaging. I knew the molecule moved because I had heard it hopping along on the surface, snapping from cell to cell to cell across the surface. Well, let's do one or two more things before we finish this up. What I want to do is I want to tell it to stop. Let's move over a little bit. This is the area where we can control the size of the image, and we'll pan over a little bit. Panning is going to be the operant word, as you'll see in just a moment. That's good. Let me zoom out and then zoom in. Well, let's move over one more. There we go. Now let's zoom out and zoom in. And now we'll image the area shown here. Right. Hopefully I got things centered right. Yeah, there we go. Right. Once you become hooked on graffiti, you're hooked on graffiti. Right. And I've always felt that having an opportunity to deconstruct ITP would be great. So there you have it, the first atomic level deconstruction of ITP. They're going to put me in an asylum before I'm done here, right? And I deserve to go there. I'm quite certain of it. And one of the things that I very much enjoy doing, and is to me an essential part of the work that I do, is something that I want to share with you now. Let me get this thing back into, hang on, let me not do that. Let's go to, video. Here we go, let's go there. You saw this already. And we just did the demo. There's an important part of science, which is something that we don't generally talk about. We know about it, those of us who do it, but we never really share it with people. And it's something that I think is absolutely essential to share. I've tried to share it with you tonight, and that is part of the joy of doing science. It's something that we very rarely openly discuss, and yet it's a hugely important component of our lives as scientists. And I was trying to think about, you know, what role that has played in my own life. And then there was something that I found in my laboratory notebook, which is shown here, that I wanted to share with you. This is dated back on February 16th, 1990. And what's highlighted in here in yellow are the words success at pickup, success at put down, success at pickup, put down, success at pickup, success at put down. What I'm doing is I'm repeating an experiment where instead of just dragging an atom along the surface, I'm picking it up, that is transferring it from being bound to the surface to bound to the tip, and then I could, if I like, carry it to some new location and put it down again. It's another kind of atom manipulation, one which I haven't gone into this evening. Right. What's important about this page from my laboratory notebook is not the word success at pick up and success at put down and repeating it over and over again, but it's what I'm hiding in the bottom part of this laboratory notebook page. And that's what I wrote to myself back in February of 1990, because, and notice I got out the big marker and I just really wrote it down. Right. There are times in our lives as scientists when we see ourselves doing exactly what we've always wanted to do, what we should be doing, when we're at our best, when we're being creative, and we're having a blast doing it. If I've conveyed any sense of that to you tonight, I would regard that as success. And I hope I've done that. Thank you very much.
Well, you really have done that. There's no question about that. We're open for questions, and we have very good questioners here at the IQP. We'll have as many as you want to ask. And then I forgot to remind you in the introduction that after the talk, we'll have our usual reception, to which you're all invited to come and come. Please join us. Bud Don, you have a microphone. Please wait till you get the microphone, which
on that elliptically shaped wall that you're making the mirage in, how few atoms can you use to do that? How small can you get that?
We can make those ellipses maybe out of as few as 10 atoms or so, perhaps even three on one side and three on the other, and still see the effect. Another equivalent kind of question, or one which we've asked ourselves, we were actually more interested in, is how many atoms from the sidewalls could we remove, and how far apart could we put the ends of the ellipse? And I don't have an image ready to show you this evening, but maybe if you can see on, can everybody see this part of the board? The question was, what happens if we do this? If we remove that part of the wall so that we only have reflectors, if you like, here and here, do we still see the mirage? And what we found is we could actually get these quite far apart and build just the small part out here and still see the effect.
Just a conglomeration of smaller particles.
If I understand your question, your question was, to what extent is my work influenced by the atom no longer being such a small unit, are you talking about the physical issue or the psychological issue?
Well, I'm talking about the fact that in the lectures we've been hearing, we've been exposed to all sorts of tiny particles.
Right.
So much so that the atom is almost lost.
Right. There are many particles which go up to building a whole atom, and these are indeed, if you like, much smaller than the atom itself. They represent a whole level of challenge for us, which it goes way beyond what I'm discussing here when it comes to imaging and manipulating. Indeed, it is very, very difficult for me to imagine doing anything like what I do with atoms just with the nuclei alone. If we could strip off all the electrons and just work with the nuclei. And yet the nuclei are huge compared to the particles, if you like, which make up the nucleus itself. Correct me if I'm wrong, David, but that's my current understanding. I can't imagine how to go about interacting with matter on that scale in the way that is similar to the way that we do it here on the individual basis. Right? But I could not have imagined the scanning tunneling microscope before it came along either. And I look forward to, you know, to finding out how to do it. I just don't know how.
Hi, I really enjoyed the talk. Two unrelated questions. One is, how is the tip made? It must be extremely fine to have the effect you have. And second, once you manipulate atoms, how stable are they? Once you remove the tip, what would be involved in moving them further?
Okay. The first question was, how do we make this extremely fine tip? And the remarkable thing about it is, we don't even worry about that. Give me a piece of metal, it's going to be a fine tip. And the reason is that we constrain ourselves, at least in my own laboratory, to working with metal surfaces which themselves are really quite flat. The largest vertical features are typically a single atomic layer height step, or maybe something twice that high. When you work with a surface that is that flat, you could image it with a bowling ball as long as somewhere on that bowling ball there was an atom or two that just happened to stick out a little bit further than all the rest. The thing, and all the rest of the geometry of the bowling ball, the fact that it's big and blunt, does not enter. The thing that makes that possible is how rapidly this electric current drops off with increasing space between the tip and the underlying sample. When that is the case, as it is, it's only the outermost atom through which you get a significant amount of electric current. Even though there's many, many other atoms which are not that much farther away, very little current flows to them. So it turns out that if you're willing to work with these very flat surfaces, the geometry of the tip really doesn't matter. So, just give me a sewing needle, that's fine. It doesn't even have to be that fine, because the geometry of the sewing needle that counts is just the last few atoms, and we don't generally control that. Now, the second part of your question, remind me again?
The stability.
That's where the low temperature comes into play. That ITP that you just saw there, I assembled that yesterday afternoon, and as long as we keep feeding our liquid helium to our liquid helium, and we keep it at 4 degrees Kelvin, as far as we know, that ITP is going to be stable. We don't know how long it would take for it to spontaneously change by having the molecules hop from side to side. It would happen, but the time scale is longer than my patient's time scale. We know that time scale is longer than, much longer than a month or so, probably much longer than years. If we were to warm up the microscope a little bit, that would no longer be the case. It would start hopping around. David's got the microphone.
Yes, I'd like to refer to the when you manipulate the atoms to make molecules. You said that if you approach the atoms in different directions, they may not bond or bond in different ways. Are you finding a lot of path dependency or independency in building molecules? And if so, is the geometry of the molecule being manipulated as well?
We've done really very little work with assembling molecules, really just only the work that I showed you right there. It hasn't been at the top of our hit list of things to work on, and believe me, we've had the list of things to work on is ridiculous. It's huge. It's just one golden apple after another, actually. What we're doing, it doesn't matter at the individual atom level. There's no sense of the atom being rotated to the right angle. The units that we were snapping together were cesium-2, iodine-2 units. So think of my hand as being a cesium, and two iodines. Cesium, cesium, two iodines. And there it does depend somewhat on the initial orientation of the molecules. We did not study that in depth.
Yes, I was wondering if you could create a quantum mirage with another quantum mirage by laying the ellipses end to end or something.
Not that I know about. I have to think about that one a little bit carefully. I did not really tell you what the physics of the quantum mirage was. Let me take a moment to describe that to you. There's a wonderful classical analogy which works very, very well, and then we'll try to understand whether we can create a mirage with a mirage. Imagine I had a guitar, and let's just worry about one guitar string. If I were to pluck it, I would generally excite several modes of oscillation. These would be what we call the normal modes of oscillation. For instance, one would be that I fit in a half wavelength of oscillation across the string. You'd see that half wave would bend up and then bend down and up and down. Another mode of oscillation would be where I fit in a full wavelength, where the string bends up over one half of its length and then bends down over the other half of its length, and then this flips. My hands are having a hard time doing this, like this, and then this moves like that. That's not bad on guitar string. And there's a fundamental mode, and then there are the harmonics. In the system that I showed you, the fundamental mode is what we call a quantum. These modes are called quantum states, and there's the lowest line mode, and there are a variety of higher modes, which you could call the harmonics if you like. Now with a guitar string, after I pluck it, I'll generally make many of these modes oscillate all together so you hear a complex tone. I can take my finger, and if I choose, I can touch the guitar string. And because my finger is small in size compared to the overall length of the guitar string, I can choose where I want to touch the guitar string. And that allows me to locally modulate the oscillations of the string. For instance, if I put my finger at a position which was a nodal point in the oscillation of one mode, it would hardly affect the oscillation of that mode, but it might significantly damp the other modes. So I can be selective with where I put my local modulator and selectively interact with the different modes according to where I put my local modulator. Now, what's the consequence of touching the string and damping out a mode? That damping of the mode of oscillation doesn't occur only at this point where my finger is. It occurs everywhere along the string because I have this resonant structure. So the effect of my local modulator is a global effect. And I can observe that over here where, for instance, I could have the pickup on my guitar so that when I touch the string over here, I can hear that the tone of the string has changed because I've selectively damped a certain mode. I've sent information from my local modulator to my local detector, and that really is the essence of the physics of the mirage. Now the question is, would the damping of a mode over here due to my local modulator over here possibly create a damping of a mode at some other position along the string? I think not, unless the system was what we call in physics highly nonlinear. And there I'm just guessing that it might have an effect, but it's 9:30 in the evening, seat of the pants kind of guess, and I wouldn't go to the bank with it.
I'm asking about the corrugations on the surface. And are we actually seeing a density wave?
Are you thinking of the ripples?
Yes, the standing waves. Yes. Yeah, the ripples, you call them. Yes, is that a...
That is indeed a density wave. To a first approximation, what you're observing are contours of constant density along the surface. So we see that for a particular electron density at a particular energy, at one position that to achieve that density, the tip is out farther from the surface, and at another position where it's in closer, and then out farther, and then out closer. And so most properly, those are density waves.
So atoms are shaped like Hershey's kisses and not little spheroids.
Okay, that's a question that we often get. The isolated atom, if it was not on top of a surface, would look largely spherical in the sense that the contours of constant electron density to a good approximation would be spherical. What's happening is, first let me schematically draw an atom stuck to an idealized surface which itself doesn't have any corrugation. And let's suppose this is to represent a diameter which is somehow representative of an atom, perhaps 2.5 angstroms or so. What are we doing with the tunneling microscope? We have a tip with an outermost atom here, and that tip is coming along, and then because it's 2 or 3 atomic diameters away from the surface, it can start to be sensitive to the presence of this additional atom, even far off to the side. And so the trajectory of the tip over this atom is typically, if this was a metal atom on a metal surface, is typically represented by a bump, which itself is broad compared to the size of the atom, some conventional size of the atom, right? And quite often, not nearly as high. It's less high than the actual atom. Now, in the computer renderings, in order to convey the content of the information, what I needed to do is to take this trajectory, and in order for you to see the little tiny ripples that were out here, I needed to expand it in the vertical direction. And so it ended up looking like a Hershey's kiss. Right? But we should not be too confused by it. Another way to think about what we're doing is we're measuring contours of electron density. You can think of the electrons as being like a fog around here, which is very dense near the surface, and then the density of the fog decreases as it goes out. Why does it look broader like that? Well, think of having a bowling ball on the surface, and I start throwing layers and layers and layers of snow on top of the bowling ball. What does a bowling ball look like after there's been 3 feet of snow dumped on top of it? Looks like just a little broad bump. Not nearly as tall as the bowling ball, but quite a bit wider than the bowling ball. That's kind of a weak analogy, but maybe it's about the best that I can come up with right now as to why the atoms have the apparent shape that they do. The apparent shape is actually just these little weak, the real apparent shape is these generally broad, not too tall mounds on the surface.
If you could scale it back so that the vertical height was the same, and also figure out what it would look like if you were measuring the contour at the surface, measuring the bottom.
Then it would look much more pronounced. I think what David is asking is what would happen if we could follow one of these contours here?
Right.
If we could really follow it, we might find in some cases that it would even bulge in like that, and then there would be some contours which would begin to appear to be spherical in there like that, etc. But we don't know how to go in there and do those experiments without crashing. Let me just, I'll repeat the question. The question was, have we done it on anything other than copper? Yes, we have a variety of surfaces. I did show you some data with platinum and with nickel surfaces. The tunneling microscope is limited to working with materials which are electrically conducting. So it can look at not only metals, but semiconductors, semi-metals. Graphite is a common thing to use. It would not be good with an insulator. because we have to run electric current. There are some fancy high-frequency techniques which would allow the tunneling microscope to work with some insulating layers. They're specialty techniques.
If you know the position of the atom, why doesn't this violate the Heisenberg uncertainty constant?
It doesn't violate it. So that's a very good question. The reason is that that atom is glued to a crystal, or it's bound to a crystal, which itself is very massive. It's part of a massive object. And that crystal is, through mechanical connections, attached to the laboratory, which is attached to the whole Earth. And because of its attachment to the rest of the world, that atom's attachment to the rest of the world, we have no problems with the notion that making the observation of the atom perturbs its position so much to make its position uncertain, or to make its momentum uncertain. Well, the position and momentum. Pardon me, position and momentum. Right. Position and momentum.
I have a kind of a personal question. When you moved your first xenon atom, did the full import of what you had just accomplished, were you aware of that, or did it come on you slowly?
I'm not aware of it even today. I knew that. I certainly knew that there was something special about that, that it represented a milestone in mankind's ability to control the structure of the world around them. That it was, in some sense, unique and special for it being that milestone, but it was also, again, I don't mean to sound false, like I have this false humility, because people will tell you that my humility is something that needs adjustment every day. But it really, for me, it was just one more small step. I had inadvertently moved atoms previously. That's part of what motivated me to get it under control. Other people had inadvertently moved atoms previously. I just happened to be in the right place at the right time and have made the right effort to put myself in that position. Although that's not why I started doing this work with a tunneling microscope, nor why I built a low temperature tunneling microscope. But it was having that ultra high vacuum, low temperature tunneling microscope which enabled me to get it under control and say, I want to take this atom, not that atom, not do it inadvertently, not do it in a random way, take this atom and move it from here to there. So it was done in some sense very deliberately, and I did understand that it was unique in some sense and represented a milestone. But you know, in the everyday battles of the laboratory, all you see are the squiggly lines on the scopes and the signal to noise, and it's hard to put things in perspective.
At the bottom of your of that day, you don't have Eureka in a black pen.
No, not on that particular day.
Well, let's thank Don again for a fantastic lecture. And you're all welcome to join us for refreshments.